College students are struggling to find Christ in a culture that rejects God. They need the Christmas message of hope and truth now more than ever. Thanks to a generous matching gift, every dollar you give to the Thomistic Institute before December 31st will be doubled, so your gift will touch twice as many souls. You can give the greatest of all gifts by sending the light of Christ to students aching for truth. Please use the link below or go to thomisticinstitute.org/donate to give today.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
Could a good God reprobate and thereby permit the eternal loss of rational creatures? Magisterial teaching makes clear that the Catholic answer to this question is yes. The possibility of eternal damnation for both humans and angels is a de fide teaching of the Catholic Church, as is the actuality of damnation in the case of the devil and his demons. This teaching commits the Catholic faithful to reject what I will call necessitarian universalism. This version of the doctrine of universal salvation, prominently represented by thinkers like David Bentley Hart and Thomas Talbot, says that the idea of hell is logically incoherent or metaphysically impossible, which means that there is no possible world in which a rational creature is damned. Necessitarian universalism should be distinguished from what I will call contingent universalism, which implicitly or explicitly acknowledges at least the abstract or theoretical possibility of damnation, but argues that we may hope, or in some cases that we should confidently believe, that all humans or all rational creatures may or will in fact be saved. Now, the only kind of arguments that could potentially falsify the Catholic doctrine of hell are arguments that claim to establish that hell is logically or metaphysically impossible. In other words, arguments in favor of necessitarian universalism. Since contingent universalists do not deny the possibility of hell, no corresponding threat of falsification comes from this direction. In order to defend the Catholic Church's position on reprobation and hell, therefore, it is only necessary to address the challenge posed by necessitarian universalism. And this is typically done by examining arguments for the impossibility of damnation and showing that none of them is conclusive. If none of them is conclusive, then for all we know, eternal damnation is possible and we can rationally trust the Church's teaching on the topic. There is another way to refute necessitarian universalism, however, namely by showing directly that it is false. And this will be the aim of the present paper. Instead of proposing undercutting defeaters for necessitarian universalism, showing that it is unfounded, I will present three rebutting defeaters, or arguments that demonstrate or purport to demonstrate that this species of universalism cannot be true, at least not if Christianity is true. Although this demonstration does not completely absolve us from the task of showing where the arguments in favor of necessitarian universalism go wrong, the rebutting defeaters I will present are arguably sufficient for ensuring the rationality of belief in the possibility of eternal damnation. Before prosecuting this case, some clarifications about what the Catholic doctrine of hell does and does not commit us to believing are needed. Universalists often presume a caricatured picture of hell as a torture chamber where God inflicts arbitrary sufferings on souls. According to the Catechism of the Catholic Church, however, hell is, quote, a state of permanent self-exclusion from communion with God. This means that hell has two essential features: permanent loss of communion with God and the fact that this loss is self-inflicted through sin or moral fault. However, besides the so-called pain of loss, which the Catechism describes as the chief punishment of hell, the Catholic tradition also recognizes a secondary pain or punishment, namely the pain of sense, which is associated with the eternal fire, oftentimes mentioned by Jesus. This fire need not necessarily be taken literally as real or physical fire, however, but can be interpreted as an image for the spiritual misery that follows from letting one's character be consumed by hate and malice. The Church has never condemned metaphorical interpretations of this kind, which have a venerable history and do not portray the punishments of hell as externally imposed, but rather as flowing from the very nature of sin and the alienation from God that sin entails. As Peter Geech writes, misery is the natural, not the arbitrarily inflicted, consequence of sin to the sinner. God is the only possible source of beauty and joy and knowledge and love. To turn away from God's light is to choose darkness, hatred, and misery. Apart from love for God, men can find only misery in this world or in any conceivable world, unquote. According to this understanding of hell, there is no torture going on there. Universalists therefore cannot argue that hell is impossible because a good God could not be implicated in the intrinsically evil practice of torture. If necessitarian universalism is to be vindicated given a conception of hell like the one represented here by Peter Geech, universalists must argue that a good God could not possibly allow rational creatures to exist in a state of permanent separation from God. And now I will propose three arguments that purport to rebut the latter claim. The arguments are demonstrative and based on premises that I think all Christians should accept. I therefore claim that each of these arguments falsifies necessitarian universalism. The first argument is inspired by a traditional Thomistic explanation of why God permits sin and ultimately damnation. This explanation does not, unlike most contemporary versions of the so-called free will defense of hell, presuppose a libertarian understanding of freedom, according to which human acts can only count as free if God abstains from causally determining those acts. Since many Thomists reject the latter competitive construal of the relationship between human freedom and divine causality, the question arises how Thomists can explain God's permission of sin. Why does not God make sure that nobody ever sins if his doing so would not ipso facto take away human freedom? The answer to this question provided by traditional Thomists is that God governs things in a way that accords with their natures. Now, all created rational beings are morally fallible by nature because the moral law that they are answerable to is external to themselves, which means that the possibility to depart from this law is entailed by their status as created beings. By his grace, God could make sure that the natural potency for moral failure or sinning that inherently belongs to human nature is never actualized, and he could do so without depriving us of our freedom. However, according to many Thomists, it is more fitting for God to govern humans in a way that accords with their natural capacities and liabilities, and this means allowing them sometimes to sin. As Serge Thomas Bonino explains, quote, "The reason for God's permission of sin and thus reprobation is the wisdom of a divine government that conforms to the nature of things as it is thought by divine wisdom. Human nature being fallible in its freedom, God allows it to sometimes fail." Taylor Patrick O'Neill formulates the same basic idea thus, "Given the defectible nature received by man, it is fitting that some proportionate measure or quantity of imperfection be permitted following from that nature." Since the fallibility of human nature also pertains to its last end, God has reason to permit damnation in the sense that, quote, "God does not uphold the defectible creature from all defect even with respect to the last end," as Stephen Long puts it. A potential critique that can be directed at this explanation is that the reason it provides for God's permission of final loss or failure seems to be morally insufficient. Even though fittingness is an important consideration, can it really outweigh the evil that damnation entails? Contemporary universalists like David Bentley Hart and Thomas Talbot would answer this question with a resounding no. An eternal hell cannot be justified merely by reference to God's desire to implement a fitting providential order. The traditional Thomistic explanation, however, contains dialectical resources that might not be apparent at first sight. And in what follows, I will suggest a way of developing this explanation into an argument that is not susceptible to the critique just recounted. The first step in my argument requires us to reflect on what it means for God to govern a creature in a way that conforms to its nature. A nature, of course, is the inherent principle of operation within a substance that determines what its powers, potencies, and inclinations are. When God governs a thing in conformity with its nature, he permits the actualization of its natural potencies in accordance with the laws of the natural order of which it is a part. Such a respectful way of governing creatures does not exclude that God can sometimes allow miracles or supernaturally prevent the actualization of some natural potentials. Now, given this understanding of what a divine government that conforms to created natures means, I will argue two things. First, I will argue that God is capable of governing all his creatures in a way that conforms to their natures. And secondly, I will argue that since God is capable of this, it follows that he is also capable of permitting the eternal loss of rational creatures. The first claim about God's capability can be established by means of a counterfactual thought experiment. Some atheists argue that the good and almighty God would be morally obligated to eliminate all human suffering, sickness, and death. And they use this claim as a premise to argue that there is no such thing as a good and almighty God. This, of course, is a bad argument, but let us imagine for now a world in which a God that fits the atheist's bill exists, and in which human beings with the same nature as ours also exist. This is an artwork called The Imaginary God. And I use this as an illustration that fits with the thought experiment I'm going to propose here. Since it is morally impossible for the God we are imagining to permit human death, he would, if he existed, be bound to protect humans from biological aging processes and all physical harm by means of some kind of supernatural force. Perhaps in a similar way as Aquinas thinks that God protected Adam and Eve in Eden. The crucial difference, however, is that God in our imagined scenario is morally incapable of permitting human suffering and death under any circumstances due to his goodness as the atheists conceive of God's goodness. This God, therefore, must prevent human suffering and death in all possible worlds, something that Aquinas' God, of course, must not. Now, human beings are naturally mortal in virtue of having a physical body. This means that the potency for dying belongs to the human essence considered in itself. In our thought experiment, however, God is constitutionally incapable of allowing this potency to be actualized. Given the existence of this God, there is hence no possible scenario, no possible world in which the relevant potency is actualized. Now, of course, a potency that is not actualized in any possible world, in other words, a potency that cannot possibly be actualized, is no potency at all. In the scenario we are considering, therefore, God's inability to permit human dying would take away or eliminate a potency that human nature should have according to its internal principles. The elimination of this natural potency points to an internal tension in the mind of the fantasy God we have here imagined. Since this God has created human beings, he apparently wants human nature to exist. At the same time, since he is morally unable to permit the actualization of one of human nature's inherent potencies, he seems to want this nature to be different from what it actually is. Another way to describe this internal tension in God, and I illustrate this tension here with the two faces of Janus that point in different directions. Another way to describe this tension is to say that there is a fundamental incompatibility between this God's goodness on the one side and human nature on the other in the scenario we are now considering. Due to this incompatibility, God is compelled by his own goodness to destroy a potency that belongs to human nature. Now, arguably, a rational God would not create a nature that he is bound to mutilate or partly destroy in this way. So we can therefore be sure, I argue, that the real God is capable of governing all his creatures in a way that conforms to their natures and that therefore allows their inherent potentials to be actualized. This conclusion does not entail that God, the real God, must govern creatures in a way that conforms to their nature. The tension in the mind of our imagined God only arises because we have assumed that he is unable to permit human death, so that there would be, if he existed, no possible world in which the natural mortality of human beings is manifested. No corresponding tension arises, however, if God is able to permit human death, but freely decides not to do so under certain circumstances, for example, given the possibility that Adam had not sinned, or after the general resurrection. A divine decision of this kind means that the human potency for dying will not be actualized in certain possible worlds or during certain periods in the actual world. However, as long as it is true that God is able to permit the actualization of the relevant potency, there will be some possible worlds in which the potency for dying is actualized. This means that the potency has not been taken away from human nature, so that there is no tension in the divine mind. And I should mention that when I talk about possible worlds, I don't have any ontological implications in mind, so I'm not a modal realist or a Scotist or something terrible like that. What I mean is simply that to say that there is a possible world in which X happens is to say that it's possible for X to happen. It's just a convenient way of speaking. Okay, let us now proceed to the second claim on the PowerPoint I showed earlier and apply the insights we have gained from this thought experiment to the question of whether a good God can permit eternal damnation or is necessarily committed by his goodness to saving all rational creatures. I will argue that if necessitarian universalism is true, the real God would suffer from the same kind of internal conflict or tension that we found in the mind of the imagined God of the previous thought experiment. Since God cannot be at odds with himself in this way, necessitarian universalism is necessarily false. Here is how I reach this conclusion. It is obviously possible for human beings to exist in a state of separation from God as a result of serious sin. Many humans exist in this state, this kind of state here and now, and if such a state continues beyond this life and goes on forever, it constitutes hell. In order for a state of separation from God to be abolished, grace is needed. All Christians acknowledge that human nature in itself has no ability to cause or generate grace. This means that a human being who here and now exists in a state of separation from God will necessarily end up in hell unless she receives something that her nature has no ability to generate, namely grace. From this it follows that the potency for existing in a state of permanent separation from God belongs to human nature as such. This potency is entailed by human nature in virtue of the fact that human beings have the ability to separate themselves from God by sin, but no ability to pull themselves out of such a state of separation by their own power. Now, suppose that necessitarian universalism were true and that God's goodness makes it morally impossible for him to leave human beings hanging, so to speak, in a state of permanent separation from him. In other words, God is compelled by his nature to block in all possible worlds the actualization of human nature's potency for permanent separation from God. This scenario entails that the same kind of conflict within the divine mind that we saw in the previous thought experiment exists in God. In the present scenario, as in the previous one, God has created a nature that he is bound by his goodness to mutilate, so to speak, by taking away one of its inherent potencies. Another way to put the same point is to say that God in the present scenario has created a kind of being that he is incapable of governing in a manner that conforms to its nature. This is not something that a rational God would do. Necessitarian universalism must therefore be false, and God must be capable of allowing humans to end up in hell. Here is a summary of the argument. I apologize if it's a rather small letters, but I'll read it out so you can see. The first premise is that a potency for existing in a state of permanent separation from God belongs inherently to the nature of rational creatures. If God were unable to allow this potency to be actualized in any possible world, he would be unable to govern rational creatures in a way that accords with their nature. But God would not have created rational creatures if he had been unable to govern them in a way that accords with their nature. Now, God has in fact created rational creatures. Hence, he is able to govern them in a way that accords with their nature, and so he is able to allow their potency for permanent separation from God to be actualized, which is what damnation means. Note that the conclusion of this argument is compatible with the truth of contingent universalism. In other words, the argument does not establish that God must govern rational creatures in a way that respects their natural fallibility with regard to their last end. What the argument establishes, if successful, is merely that God can govern them in this way, and hence that necessitarian universalism is false. So now I will suggest another version of the same basic argument, but one that draws on the scholastic notion of debitum naturae, or the idea that certain things are due to creatures in virtue of their nature. God, of course, does not owe anything to his creatures, strictly speaking, but he can, in a metaphorical sense, be said to be a debtor to his own wisdom in virtue of being rationally committed to fulfilling the plan it has established. According to Aquinas, everything that is entailed by the essence of a creature is a debitum naturae. Rationality and risibility are, for example, due to human nature in this sense. Now, as we have seen, a potential for existing in a state of permanent separation from God is entailed by the human essence and the essences of other rational creatures, such as angels. This potency, therefore, can be seen as a debitum naturae. It represents an existential possibility, a potential choice or option that naturally belongs to rational creatures in virtue of their freedom and the fact that they are ontologically distinct from God. So here is the argument. First premise, a potency for existing in a state of permanent separation from God is due to rational creatures. If God were to take away this potency, he would violate the order established by his own wisdom. Now, if there is no possible world in which God permits the actualization of the relevant potency, he has taken away this potency. But God cannot violate the order established by his own wisdom. Therefore, there is some possible world in which God permits the actualization of the relevant potency, So there is some possible world in which some rational creature exists in a state of permanent separation from God, which is hell. Now, in this possible world, God must, of course, have a sufficient reason for permitting the creature to separate itself from him in this permanent way. Such a reason is required because permanent separation from God is an evil, and God does not permit evils without a sufficient reason. We do not need to speculate, however, about what God's reason might be. If the two arguments I have presented so far are sound, and if we know that God does not permit evils without a sufficient reason, it follows that there must exist a reason that can morally justify a divine permission of damnation. Now, for all we know, the actual world could be among the worlds in which this reason applies, and in which God chooses to act on it. And this is, in fact, what Catholic doctrine asserts. God has allowed at least the devil and his demons to damn themselves, and God would not allow this but for a good reason. So let us now discuss a possible objection to the arguments I have presented so far. They both build on a crucial premise, namely that rational creatures have a natural potency for existing in a state of permanent separation from God. It could be argued, however, that the truth of this premise presupposes that human nature has no intrinsic relationship to grace, and that the natural order is fully autonomous and closed in on itself, so to speak, a position sometimes described as two-tier Thomism. Arguably, if this position is rejected, the crucial premise of my arguments may also be rejected, which would mean that the arguments both fail. In order to make this objection more concrete, let us assume that Henri de Lubac is right and that God has created us with an innate and absolute desire for the beatific vision, a desire that expresses an essential finality that is constitutive of our nature, at least as this nature concretely exists in the present providential order. It could be argued that human nature on this view has a claim to grace, because grace is necessary for reaching human nature's constitutive supernatural end. Grace is, according to this reason, something owed to human nature, so that no potential for ultimate failure exists in the human being. Now, because de Lubac is an Orthodox Catholic, he vehemently denies that this follows from his view. De Lubac writes, "There can be no question here of any kind of debitum naturae, anything owed to nature, no suggestion of anything resembling a demand. The gifts of grace and glory could never be confused with the gifts of nature." Unquote. And he also writes, "Considered in itself, my nature or my essence is no more than what it is. There is, let me repeat, no slightest element of the supernatural in it, nor the slightest power to raise itself up to it, nor the slightest principle for laying claim to it." Unquote. De Lubac, in other words, fully acknowledges that human nature has no claim to grace, from which it directly follows that human nature has an intrinsic potential for eternal separation from God. The only plausible way to exclude the very possibility of eternal separation from God is to deny that human nature and the source that gives it grace, namely God, are ontologically distinct entities. And the latter is, in fact, David Bentley Hart's position. Like Bulgakov, Hart holds that creation is God's necessary self-expression, and as such, it is part of God's own identity. As Hart puts it, creation is eternally present within the eternal act whereby God is God. This entails that in the final analysis, quote, God is all that is. Whatever is not God, exists as becoming divine, and as such is God in the mode of what is other than God, but God is not the other of anything. Since everything, according to Hart, is already God in some sense, there is no distinction to be made between nature and grace, or the claims of the creature upon God and God's gift to the creature. Instead, these seemingly binary categories only represent different intensities within a single continuum or original unity. Hart writes, "Whatever possesses a supernatural destiny, such as human beings, must be supernatural, must be divine naturally, while anything outside the sphere of this natural divinity, were any such thing possible, could never be joined to God." Unquote. Given this view, it follows that human beings cannot have a potential for permanent separation from God. It is logically impossible for God to be eternally separated from an eternal mode of himself. Formulated in other terms, Hart's view implies that a rational creature can be the ultimate source of its own grace, insofar, namely, as this creature is naturally divine, as Hart puts it. As always already divine, it's only a question of time before our natural divinity will have consummated our own salvation. So I regard Hart's blurring of the ontological distinction between God and creation as incompatible with the Christian metaphysics, and from a Catholic standpoint at least, Hart's position must be judged as clearly heretical. If this position, as I have argued, is the only one that provides a basis for rejecting the most important premise of my arguments, namely that humans and other rational creatures have a potency for existing in a state of permanent separation from God, then I think that this premise should be accepted by Christians. So the first two arguments I presented aim to establish that God's rationality or wisdom will necessarily prevent him from taking away the potential for permanent separation from God that rational creatures naturally have. I will now argue that we can reach the same conclusion by reasoning from God's goodness. According to necessitarian universalists, it is metaphysically impossible for a rational creature to remain separated from God forever, as we have seen. While this might initially seem like good news for rational creatures, on closer inspection it is not. If it is metaphysically impossible for such creatures to remain separated from God forever, it follows that they will necessarily lack the power to give themselves freely to God. A gift that a giver cannot possibly withhold cannot be freely given either. Now, a union between God and a rational creature that is the result of the creature's free gift of itself to God is by its very nature more intimate and perfect than a union that has been brought about in some other way. This means that the necessary condition for a creature's attainment of the most intimate and perfect union with God is, somewhat paradoxically, the creature's having a potency for permanent separation from God. Furthermore, since the degree of happiness that rational creatures can attain is a function of how closely they are united with God, it follows that their capacity for intimacy with God is of great importance from their subjective perspective. Intimacy with God is, from a Christian's perspective, an incommensurate good, a good so great that it cannot be compared with any non-transcendent goods or evils. It is therefore beneficial for rational creatures to have a potency for permanent separation from God, because this means that they can attain a greater share of the incommensurate good of intimacy with God, and thereby attain a much greater happiness. Now, given this conclusion, it cannot be the case that God's goodness impels him to take away the potency for permanent separation that belongs to rational creatures by nature. On the contrary, since a perfectly good God would want to bring his creatures into the most perfect form of union with himself, and thereby into the greatest happiness, he has strong reason not to take away the relevant potency. We hence arrive at the conclusion that God's goodness impels him to respect the natural potencies that belong to his rational creatures, including the potency for eternally refusing God. So here is a way in which the argument could be summarized. First premise, in order for a rational creature to be able freely to give itself to God, it must be metaphysically possible for it never to give itself to God. And this follows from the fact that if the gift of self cannot be permanently withheld, it is merely the time of the giving that is freely chosen and not the giving itself. Premise two, a union with God that is the result of a creature's free gift of self to God entails a happiness that is incommensurably greater and more valuable than any other created good. If God, as necessitarian universalists claim, were morally bound by his nature to guarantee that all rational creatures at some point give themselves to God, then no creature's gift of self to God could be permanently withheld. If this were the case, then no such thing as a free gift of self to God would exist, and no creature could attain the incommensurate happiness mentioned in premise two. Now, a God who is capable of providing incommensurate happiness to rational creatures is greater than a God who is not. But God is the greatest possible being. Hence, God is capable of providing the relevant kind of happiness. Hence, God is not morally bound by his nature to guarantee that all rational creatures at some point give themselves to God. So this argument shows that there is no contradiction or tension between God's perfect goodness and the existence of a possible world, a possibility, in which some creature created persons are never united with God. On the contrary, God's goodness entails, as I have argued, the existence of such a world, since the possibility of permanently withholding the gift of self to God is a necessary precondition for this gift to be regarded as truly free. In addition to this, the present argument also sheds light on the crucial premise of the previous argument, namely the claim that a potency for permanent separation from God is something that is due to rational creatures, a debitum naturae. This claim might prima facie seem a bit counterintuitive because the relevant potency appears to be something merely negative, a potential for ultimate failure. How can something like that be a debt to our nature? In light of argument three, however, we can see that the potency in question in fact has a positive function to play and is crucial for our relationship to God. Without this potency, we would be less capable of intimacy with God, in other words, less capax Dei. It is therefore not strange at all to refer to this potency as a debitum naturae. A final thing to note about the present argument is that it does not presuppose a standard libertarian conception of freedom. According to many libertarians, we are only free if God stays away, so to speak, and abstains from causally interfering with our wills, as it is sometimes put. Although argument three is compatible with this kind of competitive or zero-sum understanding of the relationship between human freedom and divine causality, the argument does not require this understanding in order to go through. And we can see this by considering the argument from the standpoint of a classical Thomistic view of the relationship between human freedom and divine universal causality. According to classical Thomists like Domingo Báñez and Reginald Garrigou-Lagrange, the freedom of a human act of will is not taken away by the fact that God, on a transcendental level, infallibly causes this act to occur. The main argument for this claim is that God's causal activity as creator, sustainer, and redeemer is a precondition for human freedom, and a precondition for freedom cannot simultaneously be a threat to the same freedom. Nevertheless, classical Thomists acknowledge that the fact that God infallibly causes human acts confers a certain kind of necessity on those acts, which raises the question of how acts that are necessary in some sense can simultaneously be free. Thomists answer this question by making a distinction between absolute and suppositional necessity. Something is absolutely necessary if it is bound to obtain or happen, no matter what, in all possible worlds, we may say. Suppositional necessity, on the other hand, is necessity that is conditional on some supposition. For example, given the supposition that I know that Trump is president, it necessarily follows that Trump is president. The fact of Trump's presidency is not necessary, absolutely speaking, however, since there is a possible world in which Kamala Harris won the election. Now, classical Thomists, as well as many modern compatibilists about free will, claim that certain kinds of suppositional necessity are compatible with freedom. On this view, an act counts as free as long as the person's will, considered in itself and bracketing its relationship to God, has the power to either perform the act or abstain from doing so. It does not matter that the specific act in question might be conditionally necessary, given the fact that God infallibly causes the person to perform it. So I'm not defending this view of freedom here, I'm just raising it in order to discuss argument three and see what kind of view of freedom this argument presupposes. What everybody agrees on, both classical Thomists and modern libertarians, however, is that absolute necessity is not compatible with freedom. If something is necessary without qualification, then it is beyond the power of our wills to change or affect it. And it is precisely this fundamental principle of freedom that necessitarian universalism runs up against. If there is, as such universalists claim, no possible world in which a rational creature exists but is not at some point united with God, then rational creatures are not free to decide whether to give themselves to God or not on any conception of what freedom means. What they are free to decide is whether to give themselves to God now or later. If this is the case, it follows that a free gift of selves to God is impossible for rational creatures, since you cannot freely give something that you eventually have to give by absolute necessity. This shows that argument 3 works also given a non-competitive view of the relationship between human freedom and divine causality, which I have illustrated here by reference to classical Thomism. For a classical Thomist, it does not matter if God infallibly causes me to give myself to him. My gift of self can still be free. What does matter is that there is a possible world where I do not give myself to God, perhaps because God does not cause me to give myself to him in this possible world. Necessitarian universalism deny the existence of such a possible world, and this is why they cannot consistently hold that rational creatures are capable of freely giving themselves to God. Okay, I think I will stop there and open up for discussion. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.